This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Our final speaker in this session is Dr. Jeremy Burden, who's the head of Planned Industry, CSIRO's Division of Planned Industry here in Canberra. And he says that I can describe this as a sort of Christmas carol comment on evolution, because his topic is evolutionary change in agriculture, the past, the present and the future. Thank you, Jeremy.
Okay, thanks very much. Well, thank you very much indeed for staying around to hear, this story. Really, what I'd like to make very clear to you today is that agriculture is a crucible of evolutionary change. It has been right from the very beginning, and continues to be one in which enormous change is occurring to the plants, and I'm concentrating here on agricultural from respective plants. Enormous change is continuing to occur in those areas. So if we have a brief look at the changing agricultural scene, I probably I think Colin Grove might think this is a very shallow oversight of human sort of evolution in terms of agriculture. But if we look at the terms of, you know, sort of the hunter-gatherer sort of system, there humans had very little impact on plants. The plants that were present in there were certainly undergoing evolution, but they were responding to selection which was being applied by their general environment. It's when you get the first really stable settlements that you move to the point of a dawn of agriculture. And then through that period, from that time onwards, there's a whole series of changes that occur. Short-term cultivation going on to more permanent cultivation of particular areas, rotation cropping and so forth, until you end up with the classic view of modern-day agriculture of headers heading out across a wheat field into the distance harvesting. So enormous changes have occurred over that period of time. But, you know, when you think about it, there are a number of very significant changes as well. One of them has been an increasing environmental changes around agriculture itself. So over that time, plants have tended to be jammed together more. So instead of having stands which are small and that have been, the plants are fairly distributed, they become much more compacted, many more plants in the same area, much higher densities. The nutrition available to plants has increased. So in general, the plants themselves tend to be easier to eat, and more nutritious. The water available to plants has changed as well. And all those sorts of factors have a big impact on the selective changes that are occurring in those systems. And what I'd like to do now is to give you some view of what's happened in the past, just to remind you that, you know, the fruits and vegetables we eat and look at today and think, yes, that's a nice looking one, very different to what we saw 8,000 years ago. And then from that, build to where agriculture is going into the future. And obviously all the way through this, there's this change in the genetic nature and diversity that we're seeing and the selective pressures that are going on. So what's happened in the past? Well, traditionally we look at a thing called the gene pool, and that's who's related to whom out there. And basically the sort of primary gene pool is the plants or the individuals within a plant species. So with those, out from that, there are other related plant species, those in the same family, for example. Beyond that, there are yet other plant species, ones which are very much more distantly related. They're related simply because, if you like, they're plants. And then obviously in the broader context of evolution as a whole and biology, then beyond that, there's yet another gene pool. That's other organisms, animals, bacteria, and so forth. Now, what's happened over the last few thousand years is that we have had domestication, selection and hybridization going on, leading to quite significant changes in the appearance of plants and their nutritional value. At the same time as that, we've also seen interspecific hybridization. So hybridizing species, one species with another, is not a particularly new thing. In some groups of plants, particularly, for example, in Prunus, that's the plums and so forth, you get natural hybrids occurring quite regularly out in the wild. So against that backdrop, most of our plants that we see, our crops that we see now, are the result of genetic modification. And as Darwin pointed out, it's a kind of selection that's been going on which results from everyone really trying to possess and breed from the best individuals. It's rather like in your own tomato patch. If you save your tomatoes from one year to the next, you don't tend to save seeds off the most puny-looking plant. You save them off something more significant. And similarly, then what we find that is, in Darwin's words, in a vast number of cases, we can't recognise the wild parent stocks of the plants which have longest been cultivated in our flowers and kitchen gardens, and you could legitimately carry that through to agriculture in general. So what I'd like to do now is just to give you a brief couple of examples to remind you of the changes that have happened up till now under this natural process, conscious and unconscious, of people picking out the best and growing that on for the future. And one of the most obvious ones first up is this difference between shattering and non-shattering. Shattering heads are typically what happens in cereals, in wild cereals. That is, as they ripen, the seeds fall off almost as on the point of ripening. There's a major advantage in that. It ensures that more seeds get into the soil for the next generation of plants. Obviously, from the point of view of a farmer, though, unless he really likes scraping around on the ground all the time, it's not a very efficient way of harvesting. And so one of the things that happened very early on in agriculture was this loss of this shattering habit, and you're getting non-shattering heads. And when you look at that in a genetic sense, it's a single recessive gene. So it's very easily carried across and was one of the very quick and early things to happen. But in addition to that, you know, you can look at a whole series of examples. If you take, for example, some of our vegetables, where we're eating the rootstock, typically we eat a taproot or something like that. If we look at carrots, for example, on the left-hand side here is a wild carrot, and then on the right-hand side, a whole series of things have been selected out by man because we like to have coloured carrots or we like straight ones and so forth. So a whole series of opportunities there by simple change. Similarly with lettuces, the thing here on the left-hand side, you see in your back garden, if you're like, my garden's not very well weeded, that is also one that is the direct progenitor of what we see in the lettuce now. They're both the same species. It's simple selection that's gone on by man over time. And then perhaps one of the most dramatic changes that have occurred within a species is this change in maize. The close relative of maize is teosinte. That occurs wild in Central America. And by simple selection by man over time, it's been converted from that rather strange-looking beastie on the left there to that range of opportunities that you see on the right, which are much more obviously maize to most of us. That process has occurred by hybridization and selection and domestication, and then more recently use of induced mutation to lead to the sorts of things that you see in this graph down on the bottom there, where over the space of about 150 years, the yield that has been produced by some of those heads has gone dramatically up, in this case, by the inclusion in that material of a hybrid, an F1 hybrid system. Again, something which is naturally occurring out there in agriculture. So enormous changes have been occurring all along through time. Now, one of the things we should be aware of is that new genes are also constantly being created. So this is not just on the basis of what's been there since the dawn of time, but new genes are constantly created. And there's an example here in in soybean, where simply this particular mutant in terms of flower colour appeared in 1987 in some work in Illinois. And when you looked at that in some detail, there was not only a flower colour difference, but an increase in protein, an increase in seed size. And when that was analysed in significant detail, what was found was it, in actual fact, was the result of a retrotransposable element, something which is, again, although it sounds very modern, something that's been floating around in plants for millennia, which has actually captured parts of other genes, four other genes, and then inserted them all into one, into the middle of the flower colour gene. And that's created what appears to be just a change in flower colour, but has much broader implications. So over time, we've gone through a whole process of selecting types and variants out of the variation that's already present. New genes occur. And then another sort of interesting oddity that has occurred over time and we need to be aware of is that all this has been we humans selecting, but at the same time, when you go through that selective pressure, you can do some quite interesting things back to the plants and organisms you're selecting against. So one of the things which poses an enormous threat to agriculture worldwide are the cereal rusts, because these diseases, when they get going, can reduce a wheat crop to absolutely no yield whatsoever. They have impacts around the world, and there are three major species. One of the very interesting things over time is that man has used single genes for resistance, which protect our crops. They put them out. And being a biotic system, these rusts are fungi. They respond to the selection pressure that's placed on them, and they change, and they become able to overcome the resistance. And in that process, particularly in the 40s and 50s of last century, breeders got into almost a treadmill of putting out new varieties. The rust would respond with a new pathotype in a sort of system like this, in a constant spiral. The breeder would have to put out a new variety. Made sure breeders always had a job, that's for sure. But it did lead to what I thought was a very nice phrase, which was coined by some people caught up in this. It was truly man-guided co-evolution in the cereal rusts. We were simply driving where the cereal rusts were going by the fact that we were, on one hand, driving the resistance patterns of the host lines. So where are we up to then in modern agriculture? And if we think about, in this respect, I'm thinking about the gene pool right now, prior to GM technologies and so forth. And the gene pool as it is currently really now stretches as far as other plant species. So we're looking at the other individuals within the individual plant species itself, closely related plants in the same family or genus, and then other plants. And through these processes of domestication, hybridization, whether they're deliberate or unconscious, through induced mutations, through intraspecific hybridization, and some pretty fancy footwork with somatic fusion, increasingly sophisticated applications of those traditional approaches have delivered an enormous evolutionary change to our crops. So they've gone from things that we pull out in the gardens, if you're a gardener, as weeds, to things that, well, you wouldn't pull that up. I just planted it because it's going to be my vegetable crop in a few months' time. So we've done enormous changes like that. What I'd like to do now is to just focus on what the challenges are for the future, and in that respect, why GM technologies and other technologies do offer another tool, not a replacement, but another tool in our way in responding to those needs. So I think we're all well aware of the sorts of problems of increasing demand. Whether we like it or not, the world's population is rising. It's around 6 billion at present. It's targeted at about 9 billion before it turns over, so there's an awful lot of more people to feed. There's increasing affluence. That has a big impact on what we eat, what we expect our animals to eat. Our populations are aging, so that again has an impact, and there are major issues about health and nutrition around the world. That's all against a backdrop to that is then we have, can we sustain our resource base? We need to get greater productivity per unit area. We need to protect the soils and nutrients. And in the past, whenever we've tended to push the boundaries. Pests, diseases and weeds have always come along for the ride as well. And then finally, as we're all well aware, climate change, particularly in this country, seems to be threatening us with a whole range of other further changes which are going to put pressure on where we are currently in agriculture and require further evolution to take place and selection to take place for us to respond to that. So how do we do that? Well, now, basically, we're going to spreading out with GM, you have technologies, you have the opportunity to spread beyond plant species, their related plant species, other plant species, really to making use of the full range and gamut of variation that occurs in all biological organisms to be able to respond to some of those threats and challenges that we face. And what I'd like to do is just give you a quick rundown of some of those now. Right now, in the development of GM crops, they're really focused on input traits, things like insect resistance, herbicide tolerance, drought tolerance, fertilizer efficiency. The benefits from those flow to a lot of people. And there's a general tendency to say, oh, those only flow to the farmers, so why are we interested in them? But they do lead to increased yield, reduced pesticides, and I'll show you an example of that, better water use and better fertilizer use. They are all things which are impact things like sustainability and the basic ability to feed and give everybody what I would regard one of their basic human rights, a full stomach. So just giving an example of why or how GM can work and can provide some pretty dramatic impacts. This is cotton. Cotton suffers from being attacked by this little caterpillar that's up there, Hila caverpa, known as the cotton bollworm caterpillar. In cotton, there is no resistance available to that beast. And if it doesn't have resistance, as you can see in the central sort of panel there, a plant which has no resistance, that's a non-transgenic one, and a plant which has the resistance provided by a gene that we can get into cotton through a GM route is enormously different. That gene is a gene that comes out of a bacterium, Bacillus. It's actually used often, you can find it down at your local garden shop as a dried component, the bacteria itself that you can sprinkle onto your vegetable crop to stop these things eating various things in your vegetable patch. In this case, if you take that gene out and actually insert it into cotton itself, then you can give the cotton plant major resistance. And right now, something like 90% of the Australian cotton crop has that insect resistance. Well, you know, what does that matter to you or me? Well, before that resistance was put in, and it was very heavily attacked by these insects, so that the combination of the GM technology and IPM, that's insect integrated pest management, have reduced the number of pesticide sprays from 15 a year about that to 2. So if you'd gone there at the beginning of to Narrabri and places like that in the seasons before this technology was available, you could smell the pesticide. The river was a dilute solution of pesticide. Nowadays, it's a much more healthy situation to be in. I see my timing when I've practiced this is way out, so I'll have to speed up a bit. So there are a number of examples. Similarly with nitrogen, nitrogen's one of those fertilizers which is vital for agricultural production nowadays, for large-scale intensive production. It's something that a lot of it is produced by legumes, but an awful lot is also produced from non-renewable oil sources. And again, there are opportunities there to make changes with single genes which have been taken out of barley and put into canola to have an impact. And I'm happy to talk over these a little bit more later if I get a chance, but perhaps I'd like to get to my punchline before I get thrown off the stage. Just to give you some idea, we're moving on in a development sense into second and third generation GM crops. The second generation ones, these are ones which are, you know, the development process is underway now, which are really focusing on health benefits. And then going forward beyond that is the concept of using crops to produce some of the industrial feedstocks that we currently produce from mineral oil. And one example I'd particularly like to point out there is one which people do worry about a lot, and that's the fish oils or omega-3 fatty acids. People tend to call them fish oils, and I think quite a lot of people think that somehow they're made actually by fish. They're not. They're concentrated by fish from microalgae that they eat in the sea system, in the marine system. What we are in the process of doing here is taking some of the genes which create those omega-3 oils in the microalgae and looking to put them into a crop which, like canola or something like that, which would then make those available much more cheaply. It's much more environmentally friendly. You don't have to destroy fish stocks. It's renewable and it has major health benefits. Now, what I would like to do now is just to turn to a couple of final points around these technologies. What I really would like to stress, though, is that they are not a all-or-nothing alternative. It's a case that the GM technologies are being applied where there are opportunities for major advances which are not available in a normal, traditional way. And the reason why we go that route is the normal, traditional way is a lot cheaper to do. So you wouldn't go through a GM route any other way. There are claims that GM is a new and untested technology, but there have been extensive international studies, and there's no evidence that they pose new risks to human health or in the environment, and they are subject to enormous regulatory scrutiny. Despite that, though, you know, we all recognise that there are concerns about any form of biotechnology because it does raise issues around a whole range of topics which I've mentioned there. But those risks can be identified and seriously managed. And so I'd just like to basically sort of summarise by saying that, you know, agriculture is a crucible for evolutionary change. It won't stop being so. The change is constant. Our environment changes. We have to keep updating our agricultural system to respond to that. Those traditional approaches have created great changes in the past and will continue to do so into the future. But the GM approach is now providing us additional pathways and opportunities, and as I said, largely to access traits previously unavailable. Those traits are essential for agriculture to respond to our modern challenges, and the concerns around them can be identified and managed. And then if we turn back to sort of Darwin, it is certainly a case that we, as Darwin pointed out, there has been continuing selection going on. It will continue into the future. And the major difference that we've seen over the last 200 years is the opportunity or the opening of an opportunity to make use or bring in traits which aren't available in some species, because while they are in the biological realm as a whole, the opportunity for coding for that particular trait or in one species over another became separated off sometime in the dark, distant past of the evolution of life on this planet. So thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.